Emergency exits are located in the front, middle, and rear of the plane.
Today, there's a new airline that's outstanding in its field.
And in the event of a water landing, the hay bale under your seat doubles as a flotation device.
An airline that really knows how to move.
Excuse me, stewardess.
Yes, sir.
Yes, do I smell cows?
Yes, sir, you do.
It's the all-new Dairy Air.
This is your captain speaking. I've just shut off the electric fence sign so you can feel free to graze about the cabin.
Dairy Air can give you the lowest possible price fares because each jet is efficiently fueled by the methane byproducts of 17 onboard Holsteins.
Today's in-flight meal is barley with rolled oats.
Plus, Dairy Air is the only airline where you get all the milk you can drink at no extra cost.
I don't mean to complain, but the cow in the seat next to me keeps hitting me with his tail.
I'm sorry, sir. It's the flies. It just drives them crazy.
Fly the friendly cows of Dairy Air.
This is utterly ridiculous. Don't have a cow, man.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Texas Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Coming up next, climate risk for real estate values in South Florida. And then after that, EPA rules ignore methane.
I'm Steve Kerwood. The latest climate science is sobering when it comes to projected sea level rise in the years ahead. Only days ago, the Obama administration awarded several millions to helping states and tribal regions prepare for the effects of climate instability, including flooding. For Miami, Florida, one of the most affluent cities in America, sea level rise is already a problem. This low-lying region is seeing flooding, and local politicians are trying to figure out how best to respond. Philip Stoddard is the mayor of South Miami, a suburb. He was also trained as a biologist. Welcome to Living on Earth, Mayor Stoddard.
Well, thank you very much. Good to be here.
So tell us about the situation in South Florida. How is sea level rise affecting the Miami area right now?
Well, what we're seeing right now is effects on the coastal areas and effects inland, and they're a little bit different. So in the coastal areas, South Beach, this is the south end of Miami Beach, gets these king tides, particularly in the autumn, where on the high tide, the water currents are coming in pretty hard, and they force their way in the storm drains, and the streets fill up with seawater, and people's cars rust, and people kayak down the street, and they sell their apartments and move. And so now Miami Beach is investing a huge amount of money in backflow preventers and pumps and so forth to stop this problem. So that's the coastal problem. Inland, it's a little bit different. South Florida is extremely flat. And so when we get a lot of rain inland, it tends not to go anywhere. Now, with the sea level gradually creeping up on us, it means that there's less downhill for the water to go. And so we tend to see more puddling. We've been installing pumps in the inland areas trying to move the water out, but pumping water uphill doesn't work very well. So the projection is that at some point we'll no longer be able to pump the water out. There'll be too much sea level rise to move the water out. And at that point, the inland low-lying areas are just going to flood out.
So what are the sea level rise projections in the Miami area? And with that rise in sea level, what do you expect to have in terms of impacts?
The scientists believe now that there's enough heat already stored in the oceans to melt the polar ice sufficiently to put probably 60, 70 feet of water over the planet. That takes out all of South Florida. I mean, we don't have any land that's above 25 feet above sea level. So in the long run, we're all gone. And then the question is, well, how long are you talking here?
Yeah, how long are you talking here?
I think we'd be looking into, out maybe 100, 200 years before we start seeing total inundation on that scale. Now, the problem is that we have systems that are very sensitive to sea level, particularly our freshwater supply and our sewage systems that fail at 1 foot. We've seen now somewhere in the range of 8 inches to 10 inches in this area since people began recording. And that has caused some problems. We can address those problems. In the short term, we can have a good life here for I don't know how long, but certainly the rest of my lifetime, I think. Now, will my children be able to survive in South Florida for their lifetimes? I very much doubt it.
Looking at your town, South Miami in particular, in the Miami area, how is the advent of global warming affecting things such as housing prices or insurance?
I mean, house prices are going up down here. It's still a great place to live. What we're starting to see is pressure on the flood insurance. Our insurance rates are higher than elsewhere in terms of flood insurance. We have to have flood insurance for our mortgages. And the federal government has held off increasing them by one more year. But at some point, we're going to have to start paying what someone in FEMA considers to be the realistic risk. And our insurance rates are going to go up. And that makes it hard to sell your home.
What are the odds, do you think, that the Miami area is going to see a crash in real estate prices as people begin to realize that this climate thing, it's not an if, but a when?
Well, it's we get to debate this one. I mean, here we've gotten out of the solid science into the area of economic speculation. But I think it's inevitable. And what we don't know is when. I mean, ultimately, if the water is going to cover us, real estate prices are going to go from high to zero. And the only thing we don't understand is exactly when that's going to happen and what's going to precipitate it. So my own prediction, and I could be wrong on this, but this is my prediction, is that there will be some natural event, a hurricane, a big storm surge. I call these primary disruptors. And one of these primary disruptors is going to shake people, just shake their confidence. And some people are going to start moving out. And at that point, it's anybody's guess what happens to real estate prices. Once the perception is there that it's not a safe place to park your money for real estate, prices drop. Perceptions are very, very important.
Now, what are you doing as the mayor of South Miami to address this problem?
Well, I think the most important thing we can be doing right now is educating people, just starting the discussions, explaining the science to people in terms they can understand. I don't know that I'm smarter than anybody else, but I sure work hard at trying to understand what's going on. And so I'm able to explain the science to my residents. I'm able to assure them we are, in fact, paying attention. And the things that we need to be doing, we are doing. So we are watching for flooding. We're correcting drainage problems where they occur. We're looking into the land development codes and what changes have to be made in order to prevent people from creating problems in the near future. I think we're doing all the right things. We've also got larger scale sustainability issues that where Florida has to take a leadership role. You know, we're not going to solve the problems of flooding by putting solar panels on our houses, but we need to be setting the example. Because, I mean, if we who have the most to lose don't set an example, who else is going to follow us?
Now, what about the state government there in Florida? What is the state of Florida doing about the threat of climate disruption?
I think the state's official position involves an ostrich with its head in the sand. I mean, we have a governor who was asked about climate change in my presence, and he says, "I'm not a scientist. Next question, please." I mean, that was a stupid answer, quite frankly. Everybody can't be a scientist, but you have to listen to scientists. And, you know, you hear people say, "Oh, well, the scientists don't agree." Well, scientists never agree on everything exactly. That's the process. We debate stuff. We look at evidence. We sort it out. But state of Florida? No, state of Florida is in the dark ages.
So you're a politician, but you're also a biologist. So as a scientist, what do you think when you hear politicians really ignoring this threat of climate disruption?
I mean, I despair, quite frankly. You know, this is the largest threat that the planet has ever seen. I mean, when you know, if we thought, for instance, that there was a Death Star posed over the Earth and they said, "We're going to send a big tube down into your atmosphere and pump it full of carbon dioxide until we cook you guys out of there." Well, we would mobilize all of the forces we could as a civilization to fight back. Oh, no, you're not going to cook us out of here. But yet here we are essentially doing it to ourselves through the fossil fuel industry. And, you know, we've got people who say that it's not happening, people who don't want to talk to scientists, you know, people who really have a vested interest in the destruction of the planet. How can we have these people as leaders? How can we elect them? It boggles the mind.
Why do you think that local politicians, such as yourself, are leading the way on climate, addressing climate change in this country, which is clearly a national, international issue?
I think we're leading the way because we see what's about to happen to us. I mean, when you see the train coming and it's coming directly at you, it's hard to ignore it. You know, and I talk to my geologist colleagues and my hydrologist colleagues, and they say, "Oh, yeah." I'm not sure I should say this on public radio, but they said essentially we're done for. You know, there's nothing we're going to do down here. I have colleagues who've sold and left, figured they'll get their money and take off. But most of them, I have to say, are sticking it out. And a lot of them are very dedicated to making changes in the medium and short term that will sustain our civilization for longer. And there's a very, very good reason for doing this, even if you sort of despair in the long term. And that is that we can handle problems better if we have time to adapt to them. If something happens very quickly, it creates mayhem because you can't plan. If you can see it coming, then you can start planning. Then you can have intelligent solutions to even very, very difficult problems. And that's why it is so critical that we do things now and in the short term that buy us time, that let us take an orderly approach to the changes that are coming for the planet.
Philip Stoddard is the mayor of South Miami. Thanks so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Hello, I'm Al Gore, and I'd like to introduce my lovely wife, Tipper.
Now, I'd like to tell you a little bit more about the real Al Gore. Ladies, it's not so bad to have a man that's a little stiff. I thought he was a dud with no alibi. When I first went out with Al, he was a boring guy. But then he showed me late one night first impressions can be wrong. He was strong, and he could do it all night long. And now he leads the White House race. Since that night at our convention, when you saw us sucking bass, I should have laid down on the stage and let him make sweet love to me. Let you all see how's position differs from the GOP. Here's what I mean. Behind the scenes, Al's not a robot. He's a macho sex machine. Don't think he's Mr. Clean like mom and apple pie. He likes to tumble. And does he lay down and die?
Oh, no, not I.
Al is alive. Yeah, we're making love most every night, four times or maybe five. My man is handsome, dark, and tall. How I love his booty call. He likes to jive. Al is alive.
Hey, hey.
When we go walk through the door, that Lincoln bedroom is not the Clintons anymore. In your White House, make it plain, it's Tipper's dress that's got the stain. Al's got the drive, he'll take a dive, but with his wife.
I'm Steve Kerwood. As the evidence of human-induced climate disruption becomes more stark, many nations are cutting global warming emissions, including the U.S., which would slash power plant emissions 30% by 2030 under a proposed EPA rule. The fracking bonanza makes that goal achievable, as dirty coal-burning plants are replaced by cleaner ones burning natural gas, which is mostly methane. But a recent study from MIT cast doubt on the way we measure methane's global warming power compared with carbon dioxide. Study co-author Jessica Tranchik, assistant professor of engineering systems at MIT, found that what we do now fails to account for the importance of timing.
When you're comparing methane to carbon dioxide, which decays much, much more slowly, we have this tricky problem of selecting a time horizon over which we can compare the two gases. Of course, we do care about these emissions today, but we may care more about them as the background state of the climate changes.
Professor Tranchik says methane starts out about 100 times more potent as a heat trapper than carbon dioxide, and it takes decades to break down to CO2 and water. But as we continue greenhouse emissions, we push the atmosphere closer to a dangerous tipping point, making short-lived gases like methane even more deadly. Professor Tranchik proposes an alternative method of measuring the climate impact, weighting methane as 30 times more destructive than CO2 now, but rising to 100 times more deadly by 2050.
And this has really important implications for comparing natural gas to, say, coal for electricity or motor gasoline for transportation, because what you find is that although natural gas has about half the climate impact of coal-fired electricity today, that advantage is greatly reduced within a couple of decades. So within a couple of decades, now you have three-quarters of the climate impact of coal-fired electricity.
That's methane study co-author Jessica Tranchik from MIT. Well, the MIT analysis casts serious doubt over whether the U.S. is making the right choice in pushing natural gas as a bridge fuel.
That MIT study is hugely important, and it speaks for itself, which is that not only are we not accounting for various types of methane pollution, when we do account for it, we're under-accounting for it because we're not realizing how powerful a pollutant, greenhouse pollutant, it is.
That's Bill Snape, a fellow in environmental law at American University. Leaks from the natural gas system are huge sources of methane, but the EPA's proposed power plant rules deal only with CO2. And Bill Snape says methane control is one of several climate protection opportunities President Obama is ignoring.
What he did under the Clean Air Act here is understandably and rationally go after the biggest polluters, the power plants. But even if there's no litigation, which I think industry will litigate against it, and even if everything runs totally smoothly, which is not always the practice with our federal government, the earliest that some states would be finalizing their implementation plans under this proposed rule could be as late as 2019.
So what could the president do right now?
The president has authorities under public land laws to curtail and limit fossil fuel pollution from the public lands that all Americans own. And up to date, again, he's had a number of proposals, and his cabinet officers have had a number of proposals, but no definitive regulation to get that pollution under control has occurred on public lands. That would be something very tangible, very discreet, that the president could do tomorrow.
Now, there's been a lot of talk about how the regulations or proposed regulations are going to affect the coal industry, but what about natural gas and its core component, methane?
Well, the natural gas industry, from our read, is getting off pretty easily. No pollution control that they'll really have to install that they're not already using. No control limits on methane and other greenhouse pollutants. So despite the fact that this rule really is sound under the Clean Air Act, and I think really does create some good architecture for the future, it doesn't answer the natural gas methane question. And in fact, not only does it not answer it, I think it is giving a nod and a wink behind the scenes to the natural gas industry. That really is the ugly underbelly of this rule.
Wait, you're saying this is a sweetheart deal for the natural gas industry?
It's looking pretty good for them, yes. I think the whole regulatory climate for the natural gas industry right now is very favorable for them. They're not being regulated on private lands. The few states that have regulations really are just at the beginning stage of the process. Colorado is an example. And again, on public lands, no regulation. So, yeah, I think the natural gas industry right now, under all the regulatory mechanisms, including this proposed rule, is getting a good deal.
Many of the emissions reductions that the EPA is calculating here will come about by switching our electricity system from coal over to natural gas. Bill Snape, in your view, how much better is natural gas from a climate perspective?
Well, here's the real problem and conundrum with natural gas. When it's burned at the power plant, natural gas is cleaner than coal. But when you look at how natural gas is actually mined or obtained, fracked, as the case might be, and how it's then transported, and then the methane releases when it's actually burned, you realize that methane, and this is what scientists are finding, is almost as dirty as coal. In fact, some studies have shown that natural gas from cradle to grave is dirtier than coal. So you cannot only look at when the gas is burned. You must look at the whole cradle to grave operation of natural gas, and the administration continues not really to do that. They claim they're going to do it at some point, but they have not really done it.
Now, methane, CH4, is much more potent than CO2, perhaps as much as 100 times more potent, some of the studies say. But they're not in these regulations at all.
Well, methane is not in this proposed rule because, at least they allege, that these new source performance standards under the Clean Air Act go to the actual plants themselves. And because many of these plants are already coal-burning power plants, what they're doing is creating a performance standard that says how clean those plants need to be. They're not demanding certain types of fuel, in other words, for these power plants.
Now, you're an attorney. In your view, to what extent can methane be regulated under the Clean Air Act? How is it regarded? Is it considered a pollutant?
Methane is considered a pollutant under the Clean Air Act, and methane can absolutely be regulated even more under the Clean Air Act. The Clean Air Act has a provision called the National Ambient Air Quality Standard, NAAQS for short, and there's nothing stopping the EPA from having an ambient air quality standard relating to methane and making sure that our methane in the atmosphere is at levels that scientists think is safe. And at this point in time, EPA and the White House have declined that type of ambient air quality standard.
Why do you think the Obama administration is putting so much stock in natural gas as a way to deal with emissions?
I think it's an easy way out. There's a lot of it. There's a lot of people, or at least enough people, making a lot of money, and those people making money are now donating lavishly to both political parties. I think the system is reflecting the power of the natural gas industry. I think on the positive side, though, you're seeing the president finally use his bully pulpit to talk about climate change in a forceful way. And while he's not doing everything we would like him to do, and he's not moving as fast as we would like him to move, I think the fact that he's now finally in the arena is a very positive sign. And what's interesting about the current debate and the way it's all going to play out is that there are few wackos in Congress who are climate deniers, but the real battle now are going to be the mostly Republicans who are the government deniers, who are going to say, well, yeah, climate's a problem, but we don't want Obama to deal with it. We don't want EPA to deal with it. So now we're going to get into the fights of how to deal with climate change. And that, I think, is where the president could be very useful and I think has already laid out a good template of using existing law to deal with this problem.
Some analysts worry that once natural gas wells are in the ground and all that infrastructure for gas is in place, it won't be easy to transition away from natural gas in time to meet climate concerns. Your feelings?
I think that's absolutely true. I think the natural gas infrastructure that we're putting in place in literally every corner of the country is very worrisome. We're now building and proposing to build more export terminals for natural gas. That's similarly a disaster. We're pouring a lot of money and effort to help an industry that really is not good for the general public. I think what you're hearing the environmental community saying, what I'm saying is, we've got to get a handle on that because right now it is out of control. We have no oversight over an industry that has huge economic power and huge power to harm the environment.
To what extent do you think we'd be smarter just to stick with what we have for current infrastructure, which is mostly coal, and shrink it down?
Well, I think that would be equally disastrous just because coal really is so dirty. I think the real answer, and I think you see kernels of this in the president's rule this week, we've got to get the American population using less energy. That actually is one of his four planks. And we need to really ramp up wind and solar and geothermal. That is also one of his planks. Then I think the final piece of the puzzle is to get rid of all the fossil fuel subsidies, the $20 billion plus every year that our federal government literally hands out to the oil, gas, and coal coal industry. If we could get wind and solar on an equal playing field financially, I think we would be on the right track. Ultimately, this is not a fight between Republicans and Democrats. It's not a fight between the president and Congress. This is a fight between normal American citizens and the fossil fuel industry that has had its way for over 100 years. And that is really what the Obama administration is trying to do, is trying to reasonably internalize the costs that the fossil fuel industry has put on all of us. BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, the Shell Arctic spills of oil, that's what we're trying to prevent here. And that's really what is at issue with this power plant rule. And that's why it's so important. That's why it is potentially historic to put this rule in place.
Bill Snape is a fellow at the American University School of Law and legal counsel for the Center for Biological Diversity. Thanks for joining us today, Bill.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Heaven, I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak, and I seem to find the happiness I seek when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Heaven, I'm in heaven, and the cares that hung around me through the week seem to vanish like a gambler's lucky streak when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Oh, I love to climb a mountain and to reach the highest peak, but it doesn't thrill me half as much as dancing cheek to cheek. Oh, I love to go out fishing in a river or a creek, but I don't enjoy it half as much as dancing cheek to cheek. Dance with me, I want my arm about you, the charm about you will carry me through to heaven. I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak, and I seem to find the happiness I seek when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek.
That's all, folks.